Amy, thank you for not calling me the black face of white supremacy. You laugh. That's what the LA Times called me in a headline when I was running for governor. Larry Elder is the black face of white supremacy. Subheadline, you've been warned. I've been watching a lot of this, the sub that's apparently there were five people on board and the sub imploded and they're all dead. And it's been 24/7 coverage, not just here, but worldwide. 53 people shot in Chicago Memorial Day weekend, half a day coverage, but this is 24/7. And Anderson Cooper interviewed the co-founder of the company that built this thing. The co-founder is no longer involved with it, but he interviewed him. And Anderson was talking about the lack of regulations. This is the wild, wild west. Now, these are wealthy people who paid $250,000 to go underwater to look at the Titanic, and he's concerned about their welfare. Now, think about it. If you sign a bunch of waivers, which they did, waiving away any ability to sue and then something happens, either the sub has insurance or they don't have insurance, and the next time they go down, they won't be able to go down because nobody's going to sign away anything without any insurance. So without any kind of regulation, this problem will be solved. So many of our problems in America would be solved without regulation. In fact, regulation makes things a lot worse. That's what I'm talking about here today, the welfare state, what it's done. And maybe a few months ago, I'm on Fox and Friends in the morning. Whenever I go on Fox and Friends, I get fact-checked. And I said, you know, in 1900, at all three levels, federal, state, and local, government at all three levels took less than 10% from the American people. Today, government takes 32%. And I get back to my office, phone rings, it's one of these fact-check organizations, they're all left-wing. Saw you this morning on Fox and Friends, and you said, in 1900, government at all three levels took less than 10%? Do you have a source? I said, no, I pulled it out of my butt. That's what I do. I gave him a source. And now you say government right now takes 32%. Do you have a source? I gave him a source. To their credit, they said Elder was right. And my point is, these were young people, probably in their 30s. They had no blooming idea how much bigger government has gotten to the point where the founding fathers would be spinning in their grave. My father is a World War II Marine vet. And I took him to the VA. And the doctor who operated on him or was tending to him had a tag, and it said, Olasky. And I said to her, are you related to Marvin Olasky? Her eyes got as big as silver dollars. She said, why are you asking me this? I said, well, there was a book by a guy named Marvin Olasky called The Tragedy of American Compassion. She said, did you like the book? And I said, yes. Her whole body language changed. She said, he's my cousin. And I've gotten a lot of grief because of that book. Don't know if you know the book, but the book looked at families during the Great Depression that took the welfare that was done by the New Deal, by FDR, and families that were eligible for it but didn't take it for reasons of pride, maybe they took another job, whatever. And they tracked them to find out which family 10 years, 15 years from then was better off. And you know where I'm going with the story. The family that did not take the government aid was better off than the family that did. There is a book that we all read in high school called Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville. And it's all about the mutual aid societies all over America. This Frenchman was amazed at how Americans were all pitching in, setting up these mutual aid societies, providing health care for people without government intervention. What a lot of people don't know about is he wrote another book called Memoirs on Pauperism a few years later. And he traveled all around the world, which was rare in those days because traveling was expensive. And he noticed that the wealthiest country in the world at the time was Great Britain, and they had the largest number of beggars and people who were homeless. And he thought that was inconsistent. And it turned out England was the first guaranteed state that provided welfare. And it created all sorts of unintended consequences. And Tocqueville said, I'm not sure what the answer is, but I know the answer is not to give people stuff because you incentivize bad behavior, you get more of it. 1965, 25% of black kids entered the world without a father in the home married to the mother. It triggered a booklet called The Negro Family, A Case for National Action, written by a guy named Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a Democrat, who later on ran for and got elected to Senate from New York. And he said 25% was outrageous. It's going to have all sorts of unintended consequences. Dropouts, crime, poverty. Lyndon Johnson launched the so-called War on Poverty in 1965. Fast forward, 70% today of black kids enter the world without a father in the home married to the mother. 50% of Hispanic kids do. 25% of white kids do, which was the same figure as was the case as the blacks back in 1965. Now 40% of all kids in America enter the world without a father in the home married to the mother. What's happened? We've incentivized women to marry the government, and we've incentivized men to abandon their financial and moral responsibility, and now we've got this problem. How do we solve it? I liken it to AA. If you are a recovering alcoholic, you have a sponsor, someone you can call, provide guidance, counseling. You feel a moment of weakness. There are a bunch of men right now who are retired with plenty of time on their hands. Every single one of these kids growing up without a father ought to have some sort of sponsor and some sort of mentor. And when I become president, I'm going to be encouraging that kind of volunteerism. Also, we're spending all this money on welfare, and when you send a dollar to the government and it gets back down to the intended beneficiary, maybe 30 cents on the dollar gets down to the intended beneficiary. I volunteered for a whole summer once for United Way, full time. 85, 90 cents on the dollar gets down to the intended beneficiary because so many people are working as volunteers. So it's inefficient. Aside from the fact that government-provided welfare often will not alter behavior to make people more independent. So we ought to be able to direct our own tax dollars to institutions in our own neighborhoods, churches, synagogues, mosques, people that are doing this kind of work. We ought to be able to check off on your tax return where you want those dollars to go, and I'll be encouraging that when I become president. In 1985, the LA Times ask poor people and non-poor people the following question. Do people on welfare have additional children to get additional money? The majority of the non-poor said no. They probably thought it was insulting, probably thought it was demeaning. 64% of poor people said yes. The people who are poor on welfare know far more about whether or not welfare creates a crutch or creates dependency than non-poor people. They're telling you what it's doing to them. Now, in 1940, 87% of blacks lived below the poverty level. 87%. 20 years later, 1960, it was 47%. A 40-point drop in 20 years. The greatest 20-year period of economic growth for blacks in the history of America. This is before the 1964 Civil Rights Act, before affirmative action, before set-asides. Why? It was rare for a black kid to enter the world without a father in the home married to the mother. A strong belief in Judeo-Christian values, a strong belief in entrepreneurship, and a strong belief in American values, even if those values were not being applied fairly to black people. Fast forward, we have an organization called Black Lives Matter. On their website, they attack the nuclear intact family. They were founded by self-described trained Marxists. Marx did not believe in God, wanted to dethrone God, and of course did not believe in private property and did not believe in entrepreneurship. So all the factors that allow black people to continue to grow in the face of the KKK, in the face of Jim Crow, right after slavery, are now under attack by organizations like Black Lives Matter, which were embraced by Barack Obama. Tupac Shakur, in a documentary called Resurrection, said, and I'm quoting, "I know for a fact that had I had a father, I would have been more disciplined, I would have been more confident." Tupac Shakur, the poet of the streets, saying the same thing I'm saying. Nobody's calling him the black face of white supremacy. Denzel Washington did a film called Roman Israel Esquire. He was promoting the film, he was on the red carpet, and some reporter, she was black, puts a mic in his face, it was about a, the movie was about a criminal justice, a black criminal justice lawyer. And she said, what is your opinion about all these black people who are being warehoused by our criminal justice system?
A few moments later.
10% of Philadelphia government school teachers with school-age kids put their own kids in private school. 39% of Chicago government school teachers put their own kids in private school. That's the equivalent of opening up a restaurant, putting up a sign saying, come on, eat the food. We sure won't. The people who know the school system the best aren't putting their own kids in it. What does that tell you? This business about needing a welfare state to get you out of poverty. My father was from Athens, Georgia, born in 1915. Do the math, that's 50 years after slavery. He had an illiterate mother, could neither read nor write. My dad doesn't know his birthday. He went to kindergarten, knows a year, and the lady says, what's your birthday? My dad said, I don't know. She wrote down her birthday, May 25. So every May 25, I would tell my dad, we have a 1 in 365 chance of this being the right number. So my last name is Elder, but that is not my dad's biological father's name. I asked my dad one time, who is your biological father? I don't know. I never met him. Who's Elder? Elder was a man in my mom's life the longest. He was physically abusive to her. He was an alcoholic. And when I tried to stop him from beating her, he would beat me. My dad comes home, eighth grade, 13 years old. He starts quarreling with his mom's then boyfriend. Elder was long gone. She sides with the boyfriend and throws my father out of the house, never to return. Athens, Georgia, Jim Crow South, at the beginning of the Great Depression. You heard people say so-and-so was dirt poor. My dad was dirt poor. The road was dirt. He did not have one nickel, let alone two nickels to rub together. Goes down the road, does anything he can. Ultimately, my dad became a Pullman porter on the trains. They were the largest private employer of blacks in those days. So this little black boy from Athens, Georgia, was able to travel all around the world. And he came to this place called California, a city called Los Angeles. And my dad was blown away. You could walk through the front door and get served. He always had packages of crackers and tin cans of tuna because you never knew in the South if you'd be able to get a meal. So my dad made a mental note that maybe someday I'll relocate to California. Pearl Harbor, my dad joined the Marines. We have any Marines here? I asked my dad, why the Marines? You know what I'm going to say? Two answers. Answer number one, they go where the action is. Answer number two, I love the uniforms. So my dad was stationed on Guam. In those days, the military was segregated. My dad was a staff sergeant in charge of cooking for the colored soldiers. My dad can look at a cake and tell you what's in it. He's that good. War is over. He goes back to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where he met and married my mom to get him a job as a short order cook. So he goes to a restaurant, and he's told, we don't hire niggers. Goes to another restaurant, we don't hire niggers. Another one, same thing. Goes to an unemployment office. The lady says, you went through the wrong door. My dad goes out to the hall, sees colored only, goes to that door to the very same lady who sent him out. My dad came home to my mom and said, this is BS. I'm going to LA, where I was before the war. I'm going to get me a job as a cook, and then I'll send for you. So my dad goes out to LA, walks around, and he's told, you don't have any references. My dad said, I need references to make ham and eggs? He offered to work for free for 2 weeks just to get a written reference. They wouldn't even do that. So he's treated the same way in L.A. as he was in Chattanooga, maybe a little more polite. Goes to an unemployment office, this time one door. Lady says, I have nothing. My dad says, what time do you open? She says, 9. What time do you close? She says, 5. My dad said, I'll be sitting in that chair till you find something. My dad sat there for a whole day, came back the next day, sat there until around noon. She calls him up. I've got something. I don't know whether you're going to want it. My dad said, of course I'm going to want it. I'm starting a family. What is it? She said, it's a job cleaning toilets at Nabisco brand bread. My dad did that for over 10 years. Took a second full-time job cleaning toilets at another bread company, cooked for a family on the weekend because they wanted my mom to be a stay-at-home mom, which she was until the youngest of us was in middle school. And he went to night school to get his GED. And once he got that, he went to trade school to learn how to operate a small restaurant. That is why the man was so grouchy all the time. You get 15 minutes of sleep here. 20 minutes here, half hour here, and then you walk into a house with three rambunctious boys. I have two brothers. What kind of mood are you going to be in? So my dad told me all of this in an eight-hour conversation because I was so hostile towards him because he got angry all the time and whipped us often for reasons that I thought were minor. I did not realize the man was tired all the time. When you're tired, you're cranky. When you're cranky, you can't put up with anything. And so after my dad is telling me this, we had an eight-hour conversation. Now I'm crying. I said, Dad, can you please forgive me for feeling so harsh against you, for literally hating you for many years? My dad, my Republican dad, said, don't worry about it, Larry. You just didn't know. Just follow the advice I've always given you and your brothers. And I should tell you, when my dad retired, he started a little restaurant when he was 47 years old. When he retired, he owned the property where the restaurant was, the property next to that restaurant, plus the house we still have in our family. So when my dad retired in his mid-80s, his net worth was around $1 million. And when my dad and I finished the conversation, he said, just follow the advice I've always given you and your brothers. Hard work wins. You get out of life what you put into it. Larry, you cannot control the outcome, but you are 100% in control of the effort. And before you moan or groan about what somebody did to you or said to you, go to the nearest mirror, look at it, and say to yourself, what could I have done to change the outcome? And finally, my father said this, no matter how hard you work, how good you are, sooner or later, bad things are going to happen to you. How you deal with those bad things will tell your mother and me if we raised a man. From that point on, my dad and I were the best of friends for the next 35 years. In fact, I wrote a book about this eight-hour conversation called Dear Father, Dear Son, Two Lives, 8 Hours, and people have reached to me all around the world telling me the book has changed their life, has caused me to call my dad and to understand why my dad was the way he was. These World War II vet generations, these were not warm, fuzzy people. They were not like Ward Cleaver. And I think that my book has helped people understand the hard, hard job of parenting, maybe in ways that other books that I've written have not. So I'm really quite proud of it. I want to end with this. I've often been asked, why is it that you're so confident? Why is it that you believe so much in yourself? It's because of my mother and my father. My father was a lifelong Republican, and my mother was a lifelong Democrat. Oh, for a fly on the wall to watch them argue back and forth. My father had a picture of Ronald Reagan on his side of the bed. And my father loved Richard Nixon. And during Watergate, my dad thought it was so minor. My dad thought Ehrlichman and Haldeman ought to make some new tapes, put them in, and take out the old tapes and be done with this. My mother went nuts. And my dad said, Democrats want to give you something for nothing. When you try and get something for nothing, you almost always end up getting nothing for something. My mother and my father both told us, my brothers and me, no one can make you feel bad or inferior without your permission. So all this business about America being systemically racist, even in the 50s and the 60s when I grew up, my parents thought it was nonsense, let alone today, where racism has never been a less significant problem. And one day I took a course in African American literature. I'm only saying African American because that was what it was called. I've never, you guys, I've been on radio 30 years, I've been writing columns for 40 years, I've never used the term African-American to describe myself. I'm an American who is black. But it's called African-American, just giving you truth in lending here. And we read a poem, and it goes like this. While riding through old Baltimore, so small and full of glee, I saw a young Baltimorean keep a looking straight at me. Now, I was young and very small, and he was no whit bigger, and so I smiled. But he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until September. Of all things that happened there, that's all that I remember. The teacher who was black was angry. The class was all black. Everybody was angry. I was angry. The teacher talked about how this is going to permanently stain this kid's psyche. He'll always think of himself as a second-class citizen. He will never get over this. This is the damage it's done to his psyche. So I'm going home. I knew my mother was going to have a different take. I didn't know what it was going to be. So I walk into the house. My mother was having this big pot of greens and frying chicken wings, my favorite. And I said, Mom, we read a poem in class by a guy named County Cullen, and I want to get your reaction to it. She said, go ahead. I said, it goes like this. While riding through old Baltimore so small and full of glee, I saw a young Baltimorean keep a looking straight at me. Now, I was young and very small, and he was no whit bigger, and so I smiled. But he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until September. Of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember. My mom took the spoon out of the pot, hit it on the side, and said, Larry, what a darn shame he allowed something that trivial to spoil his vacation. How many wings do you want? Thank you so much for having me. May God bless you. May God continue to bless the United States of America. Thank you. 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 Appreciate it. Thank you. Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying in politics. Yeah. Yeah. You two holding each other's hands the whole time. I'm loving it. Only in America. I gave a speech once at the Ronald Reagan Library. My first book was called The 10 Things You Can't Say in America. And so I'm talking. I mentioned my mother and my father, and I gave a little story about them, and they were in the audience. And I said, by the way, my mother and my father are here. And they interrupted my speech, gave my mother and father a standing ovation. When the speech was over, they were lining up behind my dad, holding pens, and my dad is signing my book. Only in America can something like that happen. Yeah. This is trouble. You're welcome.
My name is Emily from Putney, Vermont, and I want to ask you, do you see reform of our monetary methods as instrumental for us to find our humanity again?
I do. We never should have gotten off the gold standard. All this quantitative easing is a fancy word for printing money. It's devaluing our currency. It's making our economic growth a lot more sluggish than it ought to be. We never should have gotten off the gold standard. But beyond that, government is just way too damn big. As I mentioned earlier, in 1900, all three levels, 9%. It's outrageous what the government is taking. The only way, by the way, to solve this is to do something about the so-called entitlements programs. I say so-called because when you contribute to them, I'm not sure it's fair to call it an entitlement. But the word unsustainable was the word to describe the entitlements that Bill Clinton used. Barack Obama used it, but nothing ever gets done because if you run saying you're going to reform Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid, you'll be accused by the other side of not caring about the poor, not caring about the sick, not caring about the old, and you will lose the election. So the only way to get your hands around this, because look at our budget. Half of the budget is so-called entitlements, and then SGIP program, a few other social programs. Another quarter is interest on the debt. The rest of it is defense. A little sliver called discretionary. You could eliminate that. We're still going to be on automatic pilot as far as the growth of government. Ronald Reagan was my favorite president in my lifetime. He ran promising to shut down the Department of Education. When he left 8 years later, it was bigger than before. Government was bigger than before. Government's gotten bigger under George W. Bush. It got bigger under George Herbert Walker Bush. It got bigger under Trump. The only way to restrain it is with an amendment to the Constitution that fixes spending to a certain percentage of the GDP. Right now it's at 22%. I would recommend 10%, with exceptions for war and for natural disaster. That way, when the politicians are locked in a room, they don't come out until this is done, they can say to the voters, the devil made me do it, please don't hurt me in the ballot box. Otherwise, nothing will get done. Now, I know that's a slog, but the Constitution has been amended on average every 10 years, so it can happen, and it's my job to use a bully pulpit to explain to the American people that these programs are unsustainable, hurting our economic growth, it's causing us to be less prosperous. Unless we get a handle around it, our kids, these programs are not going to be there for our kids. So it's my job to educate the American people so the pressure is done for there to be a constitutional convention or if we have one through Congress, but something has to be done, and the only way to do it is to do it by law. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. What is your position on the Patriot Act? Would you like to see it amended, repealed, and what would you pardon Edward Snowden, or do you think
that? Well, the Patriot Act has been abused. Everybody knows that. It's been expanded well beyond what people thought. It was passed in a panic because of 9/11. I think it ought to be reviewed. Snowden right now, I believe he's a Russian citizen, if I'm not mistaken. Assange is in a prison in London. I think we classify way too many documents as classified. I think that in some cases a service was done to show us what's been going on behind closed doors. But I do think we do have some things called national security secrets that need to be protected. Sources and methods need to be protected. So I'll look at this on a case-by-case basis. Yeah.
Thank you, Larry. I was not in tears, but your speech was very moving.
Thank you.
I worked as a sports photographer starting in 1976 for a number of years. And one of the things that I noticed is that sports broke down racial barriers because winning was more important than the color of the players doing it.
That's right.
It did a heck of a lot more than the government ever has or ever will.
Agreed. So, yep.
Thank you.
You know, the last Major League Baseball team to have blacks was Boston Red Sox, because they kept losing.
Alabama football,
yes.
They didn't win a national championship until they started putting blacks on the team.
It's
and then all of a sudden they win a bunch
of
them.
It's a funny story about Bear Bryant and the coach of SC. What's his name?
Bear Bryant.
No, the coach of SC at the time. John McKay.
John McKay.
So John McKay and Bear Bryant were friends. And Bear Bryant and John McKay played a football game, I think in the 70s, and SC beat him like 42-21, something like that. And Bear Bryant said to John McCain, "Where do you get such great guards and tackles?" McKay said, "We get them from Alabama." And that was that.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a great equalizer. It really is. And on that level, if I can just digress for a second, when Barack Obama got elected, he got elected with 52% of the vote. He walked into the Oval Office the third week of January 2009 with 70%. How is it that 18% who didn't vote for him now approve of him? All of a sudden, 18%, you know what? I want my capital gains taxes raised. No. You know what? I want Obamacare. No. They thought at the very least, he will put a knife in the notion that America is systemically racist. And that is good enough for me to support him, said 18% of the people who didn't vote for him. When he walked into the Oval Office, the majority of blacks thought race relations would get better. Majority of whites thought race relations would get better. When he left, both thought they got worse. Why? The guy they thought they hired was a guy who was in Boston in 2004, that famous speech where he said, "There's no blue America, there's no red America, there's just one America, there's no black America, there's no white America, there's just one America." He gave an interview during the campaign with 60 Minutes, and the correspondent said, "Senator Obama, if you don't win, will it be because of racism?" I said, "Let's see how this man answers this question." To his credit, he said, "No. If I don't win, it will be because I failed to articulate a vision that the American people can embrace." I said, "Hallelujah." Not going to vote for him, but at least he'll stop the nonsense. And he gave a speech at a historically black church when he was a senator, and he was talking about how much work there is left to realize MLK's dream. And he said, "The Moses generation," referring to the generation of MLK, "has gotten us 90% of the way there," which I thought was reasonable. 2002 Fox poll, 8% of Americans believe it is possible Elvis is still alive. I don't know what to tell you. Yes. So maybe there's 2% we can work on. That's the person America thought they hired. The one they hired was the one who said the Cambridge police acted stupidly. Remember that? His friend, the Harvard professor, comes back from vacation, goes to his home in Cambridge, forgets his door key. He and the driver push open the door. A neighbor sees it, calls 911, which is just what you want your neighbors to do. And a white cop shows up very politely, says, "Sir, please come out of the house and show me ID. Make sure he belongs to the house." And instead of complying, Skip Gates copped an attitude, and he got briefly arrested. And he and Obama have known each other for years. And what Obama should have said to the American people. You know, last night I called Skip Gates. I said, Skip, what are you doing? You are a tenured professor, for crying out loud. You're a role model by definition. The cop gave you a lawful order rather than comply, because virtually all of these high-profile shootings and deaths would have been avoided if the suspect slash civilian had complied. And all you're doing is telling young black men not to comply. Apologize to the officer. What did Obama say? The Cambridge police acted stupidly. And that started the whole thing. From that to, if I had a son, he looked like Trayvon, to racism is in America's DNA, to embracing Black Lives Matter, having Al Sharpton in the White House over 70 times, to invoking Ferguson at a speech before the United Nations. Michael Brown did not have his hands up, did not say don't shoot. So Obama played the race card time and time and time again. Not because he believes it. I believe if Obama were being honest and he and I were having a conversation, he'd agree with everything I said. He did it because he wanted to get reelected in 2012. And to get elected, you have to have a 90-95% of that black monolithic vote. And you get that by telling black people that they are oppressed, that they're victims, getting them focusing on social justice or equity, whatever the devil that means, as opposed to crime, as opposed to bad schools, as opposed to being able to make sure that I'm viable in the workplace. Get black people thinking about social justice, about critical race theory, about oppression, and they'll vote for you, because the Democrats have marketed themselves as wearing the white hat in that fight, and Republicans have been villainized as wearing the black hat in that fight. That's why they do it, and it's disgusting. And when I get up there on the White House using my bully pulpit, I'm going to tell some of these stories, and most people have never heard them. You waited patiently, sir, for that. I thank you. I appreciate it.
Before I ask my question, I just want everyone to notice, I think your shoes are awesome.
Thank you. If the election were based on kicks, I went in a landslide.
Of course, your politics are better than Trump's, but what do you say specifically to the voter base? And there is a select number of voters who are voting for him specifically because he's a threat to the deep state. What do you say to those voters?
Well, I'm a threat to the deep state, too. And one of the things that Trump did in October of 2020, he should have done it sooner, is to sign an executive order making it far easier to fire federal government workers. There are 2 million government workers. Almost all of them are protected by civil service. It almost takes an act of God to get them fired. And he had a bunch of deep state active. We know, for example, one of the members of the CIA put together that letter of the 51 former intel agents saying that the Hunter Biden laptop story had all the earmarks of Russian disinformation. That was a CIA person who worked for Donald Trump who did that. And so Trump signed an executive order. One of the first things that Biden did is reverse that executive order. As for the people who are supporting Donald Trump, I know that he right now is way ahead of everybody else. Again, I know the man is nominatable. The question is he electable? If he were electable, in my opinion, I wouldn't be standing here. I'm doing it for one reason, one reason only. We need somebody with his policies, his America First policies, his attack deep state policies, his attack the media as being fake news policies, but for whom a sufficient number of swing voters can vote so we can win in November 2024. It's about winning, and that's why I'm doing this. Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask if you've heard of the Convention of States project.
Yes.
Do you support them?
I do. Okay. 19 states so far.
All right.
On our way to what, 36 or 34? 34, 36?
34, I believe.
34, yeah.
To
19 states have signed it so far. Yeah, we have to amend the Constitution. The spending is insane. James Monroe was our fifth president. Okay. He cast one veto. And the veto was against an appropriation bill that was going to expand the Cumberland Road through Virginia, which was his home state. It would have economically benefited his home state. He vetoed it. He said, there's nothing in the Constitution that allows me to tax other people in other states for a project in my state. Now, nobody says that. Both sides. If you don't like what they're doing, you call it pork. If you do like what they're doing, you call it investments. Either way, if a bridge falls down in Minnesota, why is it the other 49 states' problem? And all you're doing is encouraging them not to build stuff, not to maintain it, because they know the federal government is going to come in on a white horse and give you money. So all you're doing is creating moral hazard.
Right. So, Right. Yeah, it's a way to get around Congress.
I've just lost California.
It lets the states propose amendments without Congress.
That's right.
To limit the scope of government.
Right.
And
but you know Congress is not going to do it.
Right. Yeah. No, they're not going to limit themselves.
They love spending. You get votes by spending money.
Right.
Yeah, you get votes by spending money.
Also, how do you feel about the threat of central bank digital currency? That was my other question.
It's a real threat. They'll know what you spend. They know what they'll know what you buy. They can stop what you buy. They can monitor what you buy. It's a huge, huge invasion of privacy, and I'm adamantly opposed to it. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, and thank you for taking questions. Are you familiar with the Defend the Guard initiative? If not, I can tell you. Okay.
I am.
Where the guard
is not deployed unless there's a declaration of the act of war.
And do you support that?
And there hasn't been one since World War II.
Since World War II. Do you support that?
I think that it is legal to send troops without there being a declaration. There's been resolutions, not quite the same thing. But obviously, it is critical that we not commit troops unless we have broad public support. And often, we have not had broad public support. That's really the main thing, to make sure that we use our military responsibly. Peace is always the first option. War should be the last option. And I feel that way about China. Look, China is an adversary. They're also a nuclear power. They also have a standing army that's twice the size of ours. And we are foolishly heavily dependent upon China for pharmaceuticals, for the rare earth minerals that go into cell phones, and this push for EVs that Biden seems adamant about, on the dubious proposition that an EV is better for the planet than a gasoline-powered car. All these things make us more dependent upon China. So again, the military should be used sparingly. We have way too many military bases around the country. We have too many inside the country. And I think our military should be used responsibly and only as a last resort.
How do you feel about Vivek Ramaswamy's idea of invading Mexico to fight the narcos?
Well, I think that what's going on the border is an act of war. And I think we ought to consider working with Mexico to do that. But if we were to use the military right now, that would be an act of war. We'd be at war against Mexico. I think the Mexican government should have an interest in doing something about these narco terrorists. And we ought to be able to work together to stop it. The fentanyl is killing kids. It's killing kids. The open borders is killing us.
Thank you.
Yeah. Nobody needs an AR-15, yet you are here.
Hello. You said something today in your speech that made me think you really understand the concept of tansaffel. There ain't no such thing as a free lunch.
Right.
And when you said something for nothing or nothing for something, you're the first person I've met who actually understands it.
Yeah.
I think everybody in here probably understands it, but thank you for that.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, did I mention that Milton Friedman said there were four ways of spending money, from the most efficient to the least efficient? The most efficient is when you spend your money on yourself. The second most efficient, spending your money on somebody you care about as a loved one, a daughter, a spouse. The third is when you're on an expense account, you're working for a boss, and he's spending money on you. You can't go crazy, otherwise you get fired. The least efficient, most wasteful, is somebody else's money on somebody else. And that's what we're doing all too often in America.
So you actually answered a question that I was planning to ask, which was about foreign policy. And
I'm telepathic. I can tell what you're about ready to think.
Okay.
I see dead people.
All right. Well, I'll ask a more obvious question, which should be obvious by my shirt. Would you be supportive of ending the Federal Reserve?
I don't see why we need one. And it was set up to prevent a run on banks. We've had run on banks, and one of its mandates is full employment, which is not something that they can even do. And the other thing is they want to control inflation, and they have a 2% goal. The ideal inflation should be 0.0%, not 2%. 2% erodes the value of money. Thank you very much for having me. God bless you. Congressman Dana Rohrabacher. Right there, Dana. Thank you. I owe Congressman Rohrabacher a debt of gratitude. I mentioned my father was a World War II vet. My father was a Monford Point Marine. I bet a lot of you never heard of them. You heard of the Tuskegee Airmen? They were the equivalent of the Tuskegee Airmen for Marines. First black Marines. And Congress gave them Congressional Gold Medal. My dad had died by that time. So Dana Warbacher, Congressman Warbacher, calls me up and says, I know your dad got a congressional gold medal. He said, how about we put a ceremony on for him at Camp Pendleton? I said, what? And so he put on a ceremony for my dad. It's on YouTube. You can Google it. Randolph Elder, Camp Pendleton. And all these Marines in their dress blues put on this huge ceremony for my dad. And my dad got his award posthumously thanks to Congressman Rohrbacher. Dana, thank you very much for that. Yeah. Thank you very much. God bless you.